Chapter 35. Cinder stumbled up the ship's ramp, pulling her shirt away from her hips in an effort to get some airflow against her skin. The desert heat was dry compared with the suffocating humidity of New Beijing, but it was also relentless. Then there was the sand, that annoying, hateful sand. She had spent what seemed like hours trying to clean it out of her cybernetic joints, discovering more nooks and crannies in her hand than she'd known existed. "Aiko, close ramp," she said, sinking onto a crate. She was exhausted. All her time was spent worrying over Wolf and trying to be gracious to the townfolk who had brought her so many gifts of sugar dates and sweet rolls and spiced curries that she wasn't sure if they were trying to thank her or fatten her up for a feast. On top of that, were the constant arguments with Dr. Erland. He wanted her to focus on finding a way to get onto Luna without being captured. And while she had conceded that that would have to happen eventually, she was still set on putting a stop to the royal wedding first. After all, what did it matter if she dethroned Lavanna on Luna after she was crowned Empress of the Commonwealth? There had to be a way to do both. But the royal wedding was only a week away, and Aiko's clock seemed to tick faster with every hour.
"How is he?" asked Aiko.
Poor Aiko, who was stuck alone inside the spaceship's system for hours at a time while Cinder was at the hotel. "The doctor started weaning him off the sedatives this morning," said Cinder. "He's afraid that if Wolf wakes up again when no one is there, he'll have a mental breakdown and re-injure himself. But I told him we can't keep him unconscious forever." The ship sighed around her, oxygen hissing out of the life support system. Reaching down, Cinder pulled off her boots and dumped the sand out onto the metal floor. "Has there been any news?"
"Yes, two interesting developments, actually."
The net screen on the wall brightened. On one side was a static order form with "confidential" emblazoned across the top. Despite the spark of curiosity it caused, Cinder's attention was drawn immediately to the other article and a picture of Kai. "Emperor demands immediate discontinuation of cyborg draft." Heart skipping, Cinder hopped off the crate to get a better look. The very mention of the draft brought memories flooding back to her. Being taken by androids, waking up in a sterile quarantine room, strapped to a table, having a ratio detector forced into her head and a needle plunged into her vein. The article opened with a video of Kai at a press conference, standing behind a podium. "Play video." "This policy change in no way indicates a sense of hopelessness," Kai was saying on the screen. "We are not giving up on finding a cure for ledimosis. Please be aware that our team has made stunning progress in the past months, and I am confident that we are on the verge of a breakthrough. I want all those who are suffering from this sickness or have loved ones who are battling it right now to know that this is not a sign of defeat. We will never give up until ledimosis has been eradicated from our society." He paused, his silence punctuated by flashes that bounced off the Commonwealth's flag behind him. "However, it recently came to my attention that the use of the cyborg draft to further our research was an antiquated practice that was neither necessary nor justifiable. We are a society that values human life, all human life. The purpose of our research facilities is to stanch the loss of that life as quickly and humanely as possible. The draft went against that value and, I believe, belittled all that we have accomplished in the 126 years since our country was formed. Our country was built on a foundation of equality and togetherness, not prejudice and hatred." Cinder watched him with a weakness in her limbs. She yearned to reach into the screen and wrap her arms around him and say thank you. Thank you. But thousands of miles away, she found herself hugging herself instead. "I anticipate the criticism and backlash that this decision will cause," Kai continued. I am fully aware that letamosis is a problem that affects every one of us, and that my decision to end the cyborg draft without first conferencing with my cabinet and your representatives is both unexpected and unconventional. But I could not stand by while our citizens were being forced to sacrifice their lives under a mistaken belief that their lives are less valuable than those of their peers. The letamosis research team will be developing new strategies for the continuation of their research, and we at the palace are optimistic that this change will not hinder our ongoing search for an antidote. We will continue accepting test subjects on a volunteer basis. There is a comm link below for anyone wanting more information on the volunteer process. Thank you. I will not be taking questions today. As Kai left the stage and was replaced with the press secretary, already trying to calm a boisterous crowd, Cinder sank to the floor. She could hardly believe what she'd heard. Kai's speech was not only about letamosis and research and medical procedures. His speech had been about equality, rights, moving past the hatred. With one speech, not 3 minutes spent behind the podium, Kai had begun to unravel decades of cyborg prejudice. Had he done it for her? She grimaced, wondering whether it was absurdly self-absorbed for her to even think that. After all, this declaration would save countless cyborg lives. It would set a new standard for cyborg rights and treatment. It wouldn't solve everything, of course. There was still the Cyborg Protection Act that claimed cyborgs as property of their guardians and limited their freedoms. But it was something. It was a start. And the question came back again and again. Had he done it for her?
I know, said Aiko with a dreaminess in her tone, though Cinder hadn't said anything. He's fantastic.
When she could focus her thoughts enough to skim through the rest of the article, Cinder saw that Kai was right. The hostility had already begun. This particular journalist had written a scathing criticism piece, defending the cyborg draft and accusing Kai of unjust preferential treatment. Though he didn't mention Cinder directly, it would only be a matter of time before someone did. Kai had invited a cyborg to the annual ball, and they would use it against him. He would be attacked for this decision, viciously. But he had done it anyway.
Cinder, said Aiko, have you moved on to the escort droids yet?
She blinked. I'm sorry, what? The screen changed, pulling the first document to the forefront. Cinder shook her head to clear it. She'd forgotten all about the second item that Aiko had wanted to tell her about. The order form labeled confidential. Oh, right. She pulled herself to her feet. She would think about Kai and his decision later, after she had found a way to keep him from marrying Lavanna. What is this?
It's an order placed by the palace 2 days ago. I stumbled on it by accident when I was trying to figure out their florist order. Turns out the queen is having her bouquet made of lilies and hosta leaves. Boring. I would have gone with orchids myself.
You found a confidential order form from the palace itself?
Yes, I did. Thank you for noticing. I'm turning into quite the savvy hacker. Not that I have anything better to do.
Cinder scanned the form. It was a rental agreement placed with the world's largest escort droid manufacturer, which was headquartered just outside New Beijing. The palace wanted 60 escorts for the day of the wedding, but only those from the reality line, which included models with average eye colors and varying body types. The idea was that such imperfections, as the company called them, gave a more lifelike experience with your escort. It took her about 4 seconds to grasp the order's purpose.
They're going to use them as staff during the wedding, she said. Because lunars can't manipulate them. Smart. That's what I thought, too, said Aiko. The agreement states that they'll be delivered to the florist and catering companies the morning of the wedding, and that they'll be smuggled into the palace along with the human staff. Well, It doesn't use the word smuggle.
It didn't exactly make Cinder feel better about the wedding, but she was glad that the palace was taking some precautions against their lunar guests. Then, as she read through the order form and the delivery instructions, she gasped.
"What is it?" said Aiko.
"I just had an idea." She took a step back, running it through in her head. The idea was too raw and messy for her to be certain, but on the surface.
"Aiko, that's it. That's how we're going to get onto Luna."
The lights flickered.
"I don't compute.
What if we hit on a ship that was already going to Luna? We could be smuggled in, just like these androids are being sneaked into the palace."
"Except all the ships that go to Luna are lunar ships. How will you get aboard one of them?"
"Right now, they're all lunar ships. But I might know how we can change that." The feeds on the net screen shifted, bringing the ticking clock front and center.
"Does it still involve stopping the wedding?"
"Yes, sort of." Cinder held up a finger. "If we can delay the wedding and persuade Queen Levana to host the ceremony on Luna instead of Earth, then all the Earthen guests will have to go there, just like all those lunar aristocrats are coming here."
"And then you'll be on one of their ships?"
"If we can make it work." She started to pace back and forth through the cargo bay, her thoughts burning with the start of a new plan. "But I have to get Kai to trust me first. If he can persuade Levana to change the location..." Chewing the inside of her cheek, Cinder glanced at the video of the press conference, the headline confirming that he really had ended the draft. "We still need to get into the palace, but no more big distractions or hijacking the media. We need to be subtle. Sneaky."
Oh, you should pose as a guest. Then you would have an excuse to buy a fancy dress, too."
Cinder tried to protest, but hesitated. The idea had potential, if she could keep her glamour up long enough so that no one would recognize her. "I would have to be wary of those escorts. Plus, we would need invitations."
"I'm on it."
The order form disappeared, replaced with a streaming list of names.
"A gossip newsfeed posted a list of all the guests a few days ago. Did you know they're sending actual paper invitations? Very classy."
"Sounds wasteful," Cinder murmured.
"Maybe so," said Aiko. "But also, easy to steal. How many do we need? 2, 3?
Cinder ticked her fingers. One for her, one for Wolf. Hopefully. If not, would it be better for her to go alone, or to bring the doctor, or even Jason? Levana and her entourage would recognize any one of them, and she didn't trust that they were capable of creating strong enough glamours for themselves. She would just have to hope that Wolf was better by then. 2, she said. Hopefully. Names and titles dragged down the screen. Diplomats and political representatives, celebrities and media commentators, entrepreneurs and the very, very rich. She couldn't help thinking that it sounded like a really dull party. Then, Aiko shrieked. An ear-splitting, metal-on-metal, overheated processor and wires-on-fire shriek. Cinder covered her ears.
"What? What's wrong?"
The list of names stopped, and Aiko highlighted a line. "Lynn Audrey and daughter Lynn Pearl of New Beijing, EC, Earth." Gaping, Cinder pulled her hands away from her ears.
Lynn Audrey? And Pearl?
She heard footsteps thumping from the crew quarters, and Jason appeared in the cargo bay, eyes wide.
"What happened? Why is the ship screaming?"
"Nothing. Everything's fine," Cinder stammered.
"No, everything is not fine," said Aiko. "How can they be invited? I've never seen a bigger injustice in all my programmed life, and believe me, I have seen some big injustices."
Jason raised an eyebrow at Cinder. "We just learned that my former guardian received an invitation to the wedding." She opened the tab beside her stepmother's name, thinking maybe it was a mistake. But of course not. Lynn Audrey had been awarded 80,000 univs and an official invitation to the royal wedding as an act of gratitude for her assistance in the ongoing manhunt for her adopted and estranged daughter, Lynn Cinder.
"Because she sold me out," she said, sneering. "Figures.
See? Injustice! Here we are, risking our lives to rescue Kai and this whole planet, and Audrey and Pearl get to go to the royal wedding? I'm disgusted. I hope they spill soy sauce on their fancy dresses."
Jason's concern turned fast to annoyance. "Your ship has some messed up priorities, you know that?"
"Aiko. My name is Aiko. If you don't stop calling me the ship, I am going to make sure you never have hot water during your showers again. Do you understand me?"
"Yeah. Hold that thought while I go disable the speaker system."
"What? You can't mute me! Cinder!"
Cinder held up her hands.
"Nobody is disabling anything."
She glared at Jason, but his only response was a one-shouldered shrug. She rolled her eyes.
"Ugh, you're both giving me a headache. And I'm trying to think."
Jason leaned against the wall, crossing his arms over his chest.
"Did you know that I was there that night at the Commonwealth Ball?"
Her eyelid twitched.
"How could I forget?"
She didn't think of it often, not since he'd joined their side. But sometimes, when she looked at him, she couldn't help remembering how he had been the one to grab and hold her while Lavanna taunted Kai, trying to bargain with Cinder's life.
"Flattered. Thing is, you were pretty memorable that night, too. What with being publicly humiliated, almost shot in the head, and ultimately arrested. So it strikes me as odd that you would seem to be doing everything you can to figure out a way to go back there."
She threw her hands in the air.
"And you can't think of a single reason why I would want to be at that wedding?"
"One more fling with your toy before he becomes Lavanna's property? You were swooning over him an awful lot at the..."
Cinder punched him. Jason stumbled against the wall, already chuckling as his hand came up to his cheekbone.
"Did I hit a nerve, or was it a wire that time? You have plenty of both, right?"
"He's not a toy, and he's not her property," she said. "Insult either of us again, and next time, I'll hit you with the metal fist." "You tell him, Cinder!"
Aiko cheered. Jason lowered his hand, revealing a red mark.
"Why do you care? This wedding isn't your problem."
"Of course it's my problem. In case you haven't noticed, your queen is a tyrant. Maybe the Commonwealth doesn't want me anymore, but that doesn't mean I'm going to let Lavanna come down here and dig her claws into my country and ruin it like she ruined yours."
"Ours," he reminded her.
"Ours."
He shook a strand of hair out of his face.
"So that's it? Some overzealous sense of patriotism for a country that's trying to hunt you down as we speak? You do have some fried wires.
In case you didn't realize it, the second you step foot on Commonwealth soil, you're dead.
Thanks for that stellar vote of confidence. And you don't really seem like the type of girl to sacrifice herself over some hyped-up delusions of true love. So what aren't you telling me?"
Cinder turned away.
"Oh, come on. Please don't tell me you're obsessing over this wedding because you actually think you're in love with him."
"I am," said Aiko. "Madly."
Cinder massaged her temple. After an awkward silence, Aiko said,
"We're still talking about Kai, right?"
"Where did you even find her?"
said Jason, gesturing at the ceiling speakers.
"I'm not just doing this for Kai."
Cinder dropped her hand to her side.
"I'm doing this because I'm the only one who can. I'm going to overthrow Lavanna. I'm going to make sure she can't hurt anyone else."
Jason gaped at her like she'd just sprouted an android arm from the top of her head.
"You think that you are capable of overthrowing Lavanna?"
Screaming, Cinder threw her arms into the air.
"That's kind of the whole idea! Don't you? Isn't that the entire reason you're helping us?"
"Stars, no. I'm not crazy. I'm here because I saw an opportunity to get away from that thaumaturge without getting killed. And..."
He cut himself off.
"And what?"
His jaw flexed.
And?
What? And it's what Her Highness would have wanted me to do. Although now, she's probably going to die for it. Cinder furrowed her brow.
What?
And now, I'm stuck with you and some backward plan you have that's going to get us all back to square one. Right in the hands of Queen Lavanna.
What? But,
Her Highness, what are you even talking about? Princess Winter, who do you think?
Princess...
Cinder drew a step away from him.
You mean the queen's stepdaughter?
Ooh,
said Aiko. Yeah, the only princess we've got, if you haven't noticed. Who did you think I was talking about?
Cinder gulped. Her gaze flickered to the net screen, where their original plan had long since been hidden beneath news feeds and that blasted clock.
Jason had never been told about their intentions of interrupting the wedding and announcing her identity to the world.
Nobody?
She stammered, scratching her wrist.
So, when you say you're loyal to your princess, you're talking about her, right?
Jason peered at her like he couldn't figure out why he was wasting his time with such an idiot. Cinder cleared her throat.
Right.
I should have let Sybil have you, he muttered, shaking his head. I thought maybe the princess would be proud if she heard about me turning against Sybil, that she would approve of my decision. But who am I kidding? She'll never even know.
Do you love her?
He glared at her, disgusted. Don't try to push your swoony psychodrama on me. I'm sworn to protect her. Can't very well do that from down here, can I?
Protect her from what? Lavanna?
Among other things.
Cinder collapsed onto one of the storage crates, feeling like she'd just sprinted halfway across the desert. Her body was drained, her brain frazzled. Jason didn't care about her at all. He was loyal to the queen's stepdaughter. She hadn't even known the queen's stepdaughter had people who were loyal to her.
Help me, she said, not hiding the pleading in her tone as she met Jason's gaze again.
I swear to you, I can stop Lavanna. I can get you back to Luna, where you can protect your princess or do whatever you need to do. But I need help.
That much is pretty obvious. Are you going to let me in on this miracle plan of yours?
She gulped.
Maybe. Eventually. He shook his head, looking like he wanted to laugh as he gestured out toward the streets of Farafra. You're just desperate because the strongest ally you have right now is lying in a drug-induced coma.
Wolf is going to be fine, Cinder said, with more conviction than she expected.
Then she sighed.
I'm desperate because I need as many allies as I can get.
Chapter 36. They stopped again that night, and Cress was given some bread, dried fruit, and water. She listened to the sounds of camp outside the van and tried to sleep, but it came only in fits. They started early again the next morning. She became less and less sure that Thorn would come for her. She kept seeing him embracing that other woman, and imagined that he was glad he no longer had to bother himself with the weak, naive lunar shell. Even the fantasies that had consoled and comforted her for so many years aboard the satellite were growing feeble. She was not a warrior, brave and strong and ready to defend justice. She was not the most beautiful girl in the land, able to evoke empathy and respect from even the most hard-hearted villain. She was not even a damsel knowing that a hero would someday rescue her. Instead, she spent the agonizing hours wondering whether she was to become a slave, a servant, a feast for cannibals, a human sacrifice, or whether she would be returned to Queen Lavanna and tortured for her betrayal. Eventually, late in the second day of her entrapment, the vans stopped and the doors were thrown open. Cress cringed at the brightness and tried to scuffle away, but she was grabbed and hauled outside. She landed on her knees. Pain shot up her spine, but her captor ignored her whimpering as he tugged her to her feet and bound her wrists. The pain soon faded, trounced by adrenaline and curiosity. They'd arrived at a new town, but even she could tell this one had never been as wealthy or populated as Kufra. Modest buildings the color of the desert stretched down a sand-spotted road. Walls of red clay, painted indigo and pink, had long been bleached in the sun, their roofs covered with broken tiles. A fenced area not far away held half a dozen camels, and there were a few more wheeled, dirty vehicles stationed along the street, and she blinked the sun and sand from her eyes. A spaceship sat in the center of town. A Rampian. Her heart skipped with frenzied hope, but it was quickly smothered. Even from this distance, she could see that the Rampian's main hatch was painted black, not adorned with a lounging lady, as had been reported when Thorne's ship landed in France. She whimpered, tearing her eyes away as her captors herded her into the nearest building. They entered a dark hallway. Only a small window in the front let in any light, and it had been caked with windblown sand over the years. There was a tiny desk set into a corner with a board of old-fashioned keys hanging on the wall. Cress was shuffled past it and taken to the end of the corridor. The walls reeked with something pungent. Not a bad scent, but too overpowering to be pleasant. Cress's nose tickled. She was pushed up a staircase, so thin that she had to follow behind Gina, with Niels behind her. An eerie silence haunted the sand-colored walls. The stench was stronger up here, and a shiver raced down her spine, making goosebumps bloom across her arms. Her fear had bundled itself up in a cluster of nerves at the base of her spine. By the time they reached the last door in the hallway and Gina raised her fist to knock, Cress was shaking so hard she almost couldn't stand. She was surprised to find herself longing for the security of the van. Gina had to knock twice before they heard footsteps and the creak of the door. Niels kept Cress tucked securely behind Gina, and all she could see were the cuffs of a man's brown trousers and worn white shoes with fraying laces.
"Gina," said a man, sounding like he'd just woken from a nap. "I heard a rumor out of Kufra that you were on your way."
"I've brought you another subject. Found her wandering in the desert."
A hesitation. Then the man said without question, "A shell." His certainty made Cress squirm. If he had not had to ask, that meant he could sense her. Or rather, couldn't sense her. She remembered Sybil complaining that she could not sense Cress's thoughts, how much more difficult it was to train and command a person like her, as if it were all Cress's doing. This man was lunar. She flinched away, wanting to curl up until she was no larger than a grain of sand, until she blew away into the desert and disappeared. But she could not disappear. Instead, as Gina stepped aside, she found herself face to face with a man well into his years. She started. They were face to face. He was barely taller than her. Behind a pair of thin wired spectacles, his blue eyes widened, looking remarkably lively despite the wrinkles that folded and creased around them. He was balding, with tufts of untamed gray hair that stuck out above his ears. A bizarre deja vu struck her, as if she'd seen him before, but that was impossible. He whipped off his spectacles and rubbed at his eyes. When he replaced them, his lips were puckered, and he was examining Cress like a bug for dissection. She pressed back against the wall until Niels grabbed her elbow and yanked her forward.
"Definitely a shell," the old man murmured, "and a phantom, it seems."
Cress's heart pounded a rough, erratic rhythm against her ribcage.
"I'm asking 32,000 univs for her."
The man blinked at Gina like he'd forgotten she was there. He stood a bit straighter and made a great fuss about removing his spectacles again to clean them this time.
Cress dug her fingernails into her palm to distract herself from her panic. She stared past the man. A single window was covered in blinds, and there was dust swirling in and out of a beam of sunlight that knifed through them. There was a closed door, presumably a closet, a desk, a bed, and a pile of rumpled blankets in the corner. The blankets were clotted with blood. A chill raced across her skin. Then she spotted the net screen. A net screen. She could come for help. She could contact the last hotel in Kufra. She could tell Thorn, "I will give you 25,000. The man's tone had solidified while he cleaned his glasses and was now all business. Gina snorted.
"I will not hesitate to take this girl to the police and have her deported. I'll collect my citizens' reward from them." "A mere 1,500 univs? You would sacrifice so much on your pride, Gina?" "My pride, and to know that one less Luna is walking around on my planet."
She said this with a sneer, and for the first time, it occurred to Cress that Gina might truly hate her, for no other reason than her ancestry.
"I let her go for 30,000, Doctor. I know you're paying as much for shells these days."
"Doctor," Cress gulped. This man in no way resembled the finely polished men and women in the net dramas, with their crisp white coats and advanced technology. Somehow the title served to make her more wary, as visions of scalpels and syringes flashed through her mind. He sighed.
"Ah, 27,000.
Gina tilted her head back, peered down her nose.
"Deal."
The doctor took her hand, but he seemed to have drawn back into himself. He couldn't look at Cress full on, as if he were ashamed that she had witnessed the transaction. Defiance jolted down Cress's spine. He should be ashamed. They should all be ashamed. And she would not let herself become mere baggage to be bartered for. Mistress Sybil had taken advantage of her for too long. She wouldn't let it happen again. Before these thoughts could become anything more than rebellious anger, she was shoved into the room. Gina shut the door, enclosing them all in the hot, dusty space that smelled of stale chemicals.
"Make the transfer quick," she said, folding her arms. "I have other business to tend to in Kufra."
The doctor grunted and opened the closet. There were no clothes inside, but rather a miniature science lab with mystery machines and scanners and a stand of metal drawers that clanked when he opened them. He pulled out a needle and syringe and made quick work of removing its packaging. Cress backed away, arms pulling against her bindings, but Niels stopped her.
"Yes, yes, let me get a blood sample from her, then I'll make the transfer."
"Why?"
Gina said, stepping between them. "So you can determine something's wrong with her and compromise our deal?"
The doctor harumphed.
"I have no intention of compromising anything, Gina. I merely thought she would be more complicit while you're here, allowing me to more safely extract the sample."
Cress's gaze darted around the room. A weapon, an escape, a hint of mercy in the eyes of her captor. Nothing. There was nothing.
"Fine," Gina said. "Niels, hold her so the doctor can do what he needs to do."
"No!" The word was ripped out of Cress as she stumbled away. Her shoulder collided with Niels, and she started to fall backward. But then he was gripping her by the elbow and hauling her against him. Her legs had become soggy and useless beneath her.
"No, please, leave me alone,"
she pleaded at the doctor and saw such a mixture of emotion on his lined face that she fell silent. His eyebrows were bunched together and his mouth tightly pursed. He kept rapidly blinking behind his glasses, like trying to clear away an eyelash, until his gaze fell away from her altogether. There was pity in him. She knew it. She knew this was sympathy he was trying to disguise.
"Please," she sobbed. "Please let me go. I'm just a shell, and I'm stranded here on Earth, and I haven't done anything to anyone, and I'm nobody. I'm nobody. Please just let me go."
He did not meet her eyes again, even as he stepped forward. She tensed, trying to back away, but Niels held her firm. The doctor's touch felt papery, but his grip was strong as he took her wrist in one hand.
"Try to relax," he murmured.
She flinched as the needle dug into her flesh, the same spot where Sybil had taken blood 100 times. She bit hard on the inside of her cheek, refusing to so much as whimper.
That was all. Not so awful, was it?
His tone was eerily soft, like he was trying to comfort her. She felt like a bird who'd had her wings clipped and been thrown into a cage. Another filthy, rotting cage.
She'd been in a cage all her life. Somehow, she'd never expected to find one just as awful on Earth.
Earth, she reminded herself as the doctor plodded back across the groaning floorboards. She was on Earth, not trapped in a satellite in space. There was a way out of this. Freedom was just out that window, or just down those stairs. She would not be a prisoner again. The doctor fit the syringe full of her blood into a machine and flipped on a port screen.
There now, I will transfer over the funds and you can be on your way. You're using a secure connection?
Gina asked, taking a step forward as the doctor tapped in some sort of code word. Kress squinted, watching where his fingers landed in case she would later need it. It could save time not having to hack it.
Trust me, Gina. I have more reason than you to keep my transactions hidden from prying eyes.
He studied something on the screen, before saying more solemnly,
Thank you for bringing her.
Gina scowled at his balding head.
I hope you're killing all these Lunas when you're done with them. We have enough problems with the plague. We don't need them, too.
His blue eyes flashed, and Kress detected a hint of disdain for Gina, but he covered it over with another benign look.
The payment has been transferred. If you would untie the girl before you go.
Kress kept still as the bindings were taken off her wrists. She whipped her hands away as soon as they were gone and scurried against the nearest wall.
Lovely doing business with you again, Gina said.
The doctor merely grunted. He was watching Kress from the corner of his eye, trying to stare at her without being obvious. And then the door closed and Gina and Niels were gone. Kress listened to their feet clopping down the hallway, the only noise in the building. The doctor rubbed his palms down the front of his shirt, like cleansing them of Gina's presence. Kress didn't think he could feel half as filthy as she did, but she stayed as still as the wall. Glaring.
Yes, well, he said. It's more awkward with shells, you know, not so easy to explain.
She snarled.
You mean not so easy to brainwash?
He tilted his head, and the odd look had returned, the one that made her feel like a science experiment under a microscope.
You know that I'm lunar.
She didn't answer.
I understand you're frightened. I can't imagine what sort of mistreatment Gina and her hooligans put you through, but I'm not going to hurt you. In fact, I'm doing great things here, things that will change the world, and you can help me.
He paused.
What is your name, child?
She didn't answer. When he moved closer, his hands extended in a show of peace. Kress shoved all her fear down into her gut and used the wall to launch herself at him. A roar clawed up from her throat, and she swung her elbow as hard as she could, landing a solid hit against his jaw. She heard the snap of his teeth, felt the shock in her bones, and then he was falling backward and landing so hard on the wooden floor that the entire building shook around them. She didn't check to see if he was unconscious, or if she'd given him a heart attack, or if he was in any shape to get up and follow her. She wrenched open the door and ran. Chapter 37. Dr. Erland woke up on the floor of a hot, dusty hotel room, unable for a moment to remember where he was. This was not the laboratories beside New Beijing Palace, where he'd watched cyborg after cyborg break into red and purple rashes, where he'd seen the life drain out of their eyes and cursed the sacrifice of another life while plotting the next step in his hunt for the only cyborg that mattered. This was not the labs of Luna, where he'd studied and researched with a singular drive for recognition, where he'd seen monsters born at the end of his surgical tools,
where he'd watched the brainwaves of young men take on the chaotic, savage patterns of wild animals. He was not Dr. Dmitri Erland, as he'd been in New Beijing. He was not Dr. Sage Darnell, as he'd been on Luna. Or perhaps he was. He couldn't think, couldn't remember. Didn't care. His thoughts kept turning away from himself and his two hateful identities, and swarming back to his wife's heart-shaped face and honey-blonde hair that became frizzy whenever the ecology department was injecting new humidity into Luna's controlled atmosphere. His thoughts were on a screaming baby, 4 days old and confirmed a shell, as his wife dropped her into the hands of Thaumaturge Mira, with all the coldness and disgust she would have shown a rodent. The last time he'd seen his little crescent moon. He watched the whirling ceiling fan that did nothing to dispel the desert heat and wondered why, after all these years, his hallucinations had chosen this time to torture him. This shell girl did not really have his wife's freckles or blonde hair. This shell girl did not have his unfortunate height or his own blue eyes. This shell girl was not his daughter, returned from the dead to haunt him. The illusion was all in his mind. Perhaps it was fitting. He'd done so many horrible things. The recent attack on Earth was only the culmination of years of his own efforts. It was through his own research that Queen Chanary had begun developing her army of wolf hybrids, and through his experiments that Lavanna was able to see it to its bloody finale. And then there were all those he'd hurt to find Celine and end Lavanna's reign. All those he'd murdered to find Lynn Cinder. He'd been too optimistic to think he could repay those debts now. He'd tried hard to duplicate the antidote Lavanna had given to Emperor Kaito. He'd had to try, and for his pains, more sacrifices, more blood samples, more experiments, though now he was forced to find true volunteers when the traffickers couldn't bring him new blood or their own. He had discovered back in New Beijing, when he'd studied the antidote brought by Queen Lavanna, that lunar shells held the secret. The same genetic mutation that made them immune to the lunar tampering of bioelectricity could be used to create antibodies that would fight off and defeat the disease. And so he'd begun gathering shells and their blood and their DNA, using them just as he'd used the young men who had become mindless soldiers for the queen, just as he'd used the cyborgs who were too often unwilling candidates of the Letimosis experimentation. Of course his brain would do this to him. Of course his insanity would reach such a depth that the hallucinations would return to him the only thing he had ever cared for. And they would twist reality so that she became just another one of his victims. Just another person bought and discarded. Just another blood sample. Just another lab rat who hated him. His little crescent moon. Over his head, his port screen dinged on his laboratory shelf. It took more energy than he thought he had to pull himself to his feet, groaning as he used the age-polished bedpost for leverage. He took his time, avoiding the truth, partly because he didn't know what he wanted the truth to be. A hallucination he could deal with. He could write it off and continue with his work. But if it was her? He could not lose her one more time. He passed the open closet and pushed aside the window blinds, glancing out onto the street. He could see the curve of the ship 2 streets away, reflecting the sunlight as dusk set in. He should get this over with before Cinder came back to check on her wolf friend. He had not had any subjects sold to him since she'd been here, and he did not think she would understand. She had such a tough time understanding the sacrifices that had to be made for the good of all. She, who should understand better than anyone. Sighing, he paced back to the small lab setup and the girl's blood sample. He picked up the port screen and clicked on the report generated from the test. He felt woozy as he scanned the data culled from her DNA. Lunar. Shell. Height. Fully grown. 153.48 centimeters. Martin Schultz scale iris pigmentation, 3. Melanin production, 28/100, with localized concentrated melanin to face, /ephelis. Her physical statistics were followed by a list of potential diseases and genetic weaknesses, with suggestions for treatments and preventions. It did not tell him what he needed to know until he steeled himself and linked her chart to his own, a chart that he had practically memorized for as many times as he had taken his own blood for experimentation. He sat down on the edge of the bed while the computer ran through the charts, comparing and contrasting more than 40,000 genes. He found himself hoping that the hallucination was true and she was not his daughter, that his daughter had been killed by Sybil Mira, as he'd been led to believe so many years ago. Because if it was her, she would despise him. And he would agree with her. She was gone already, he was sure. He didn't know how long he'd been unconscious, but he doubted she would stay close. He had already lost that little ghost. Twice now. The port screen finished running the comparison. Match found. Paternity confirmed. He took off his spectacles and set them on the desk and exhaled a long, trembling breath. His crescent moon was alive. Chapter 38. Cress held her breath and listened so hard it was giving her a headache, but all she heard was silence. Her left leg was beginning to cramp from being curled into such an awkward position, but she dared not move for fear she would bump something and alert the old man to her location. She hadn't run from the hotel. Though she'd been tempted, she'd known that Gina and the others could still be out there, and running into them would put her right back where she'd started. Instead, she ducked into the third room down the long, slender corridor, surprised to find the door unlocked and the room abandoned. It had the same setup as the doctor's room: bed, closet, desk, but to her chagrin, it was missing a net screen. If she hadn't been so desperate to find a hiding spot, she would have wept. She ended up in the closet. It was empty, with a bar for hanging clothes situated below a single shelf. Cress had used all her strength to clamber up onto that shelf, propelling up the closet's side walls with both feet before squeezing her way into the tiny alcove. She'd used her toes to pull the door shut. For once, she was glad of her small size, and she figured that if he found her, she'd at least have the leverage from being so high up. She wished she would have thought to grab some sort of weapon. But her hope was that there would be no need for it. She suspected that when he woke up, he would think she'd run out into the town and would go searching for her, which should give her ample time to get back to that net screen and contact Thorne at their last hotel. She had lain there for hours, waiting and listening. Though it was uncomfortable, it kind of reminded her of sleeping beneath the bed in the satellite during those long hours when Luna could be seen through her windows. She'd always felt safe then, and the memory brought a strange sense of protection, even now. After a while, she began to wonder whether she'd killed the man. The guilt that sparked in her chest made her angry. She had nothing to feel guilty about. She'd been defending herself, and he was a lunar trafficking monster. Not long after she'd had this thought, she heard shuffling, so quiet it could have been a mouse in the walls. It was followed by a couple of thumps and a groan. Her body seized up again, her right shoulder aching from the way she was lying on it. This had been a mistake. She should have run when she'd had the chance. Or she should have used the time that he was unconscious to tap into his net screen. In hindsight, she'd had plenty of time, but now it was too late and he was awake and he would find her and... She squeezed her eyes shut until white specks flickered in the darkness. Her plan had not failed yet. He could still go outside in search of her. He could still leave the building. She waited. And waited. Breathing in and breathing out. Filling herself with hot, stifling air. Her pulse skipped at every sound. Every muffled scrape. Every wooden thump. Trying to create a picture in her mind of what was happening in the room at the end of the hall.
he never left his room. He didn't come to look for her at all. She scowled into the darkness, a bead of sweat lobbed its way off her nose. When solid darkness had crept into her closet and, despite the discomfort and stiff muscles, Cress found herself dozing off. She snapped herself awake and determined that she had hidden long enough. The old man wasn't searching for her, which seemed absurd, knowing how much he'd paid for her. Shouldn't he have been a little more concerned? Or maybe all he'd really wanted was her blood. It was a peculiar coincidence, given how Mistress Sybil had saved so many non-gifted infants from death because she'd seen some value in their blood, too. She tried not to let her suspicions and paranoia dig any deeper. Whatever the old man wanted, she couldn't stay in this closet forever. Tilting one foot off the shelf, she nudged open the closet door. It squeaked, a sound that was drum-shatteringly loud, and she froze with one leg extended, waiting, listening. When nothing happened, she prodded the door open a bit more and shimmied to the edge of the shelf. She lowered herself as gently as she could down to the floor. The floorboards groaned. She halted again, heartbeat thundering, waited, listened. Dizzy and parched, Cress made her way to the corridor. It was empty. She crept to the next door. Again, it was unlocked, but the room looked exactly like the one she'd just left, abandoned and empty. Her skin was crawling, every sense heightened as she shut the door and moved on to the next. In the third room, the blinds were closed, but the light from the corridor fell on a net screen hanging in the darkness. She barely stifled a gasp. Trembling with anticipation, she shut the door behind her. Then her attention landed on the bed, and she pressed a hand over her mouth. A man was lying there, sleeping, she realized, as she waited for her heartbeat to stop thudding so painfully against her ribs. She dared not move until she could be certain that the rise and fall pattern of his chest was steady and deep. She hadn't woken him. She glanced at the net screen again, weighing the risks. She could slip into the corridor again and keep searching. There were two doors on this floor she hadn't yet opened, but they were both back toward the old man's room. Or she could go downstairs and try her luck there. But every step she took on the old floorboards could alert someone to her presence, and she had no guarantee that any of the other doors would be unlocked, or that they would have net screens. The minutes ticked by as she stood with one hand on the doorknob, the other over her mouth, trapped by indecision. The man never stirred, never so much as twitched. Finally, she forced herself to take a step toward the net screen. Her gaze darted to the sleeping form again and again, making sure that his breathing didn't change. "Net screen," she whispered. "On." The screen flickered and she began repeating, "Net screen mute. Net screen mute. Net screen." But her command was unnecessary. As the net screen brightened, she found herself staring at a map of Earth, not at a net drama or newsfeed. Four locations had been marked: New Beijing, Paris, Rieu, France, a tiny oasis town in the northwest corner of Nile Province in the African Union. A sense of coincidence stirred in her, but her brain was already skimming too far ahead to dwell on it. Within moments, she had sent the map away and called up a comm link. She hesitated. The only time she'd ever sent a comm was when she talked to Cinder, using a link that couldn't be traced or monitored. She knew intimately how much access Queen Lavanna had to Earth's net and all those comms that Earthans mistakenly believed were private. But she couldn't dwell on that. What interest would Queen Lavanna have in a single comm link established between two small towns in North Africa? She was, no doubt, far too preoccupied with her plans for intergalactic dominance. "Net screen," she whispered. "Show hotels in Kufra." Her awkward pronunciation brought up a list of 7 possible Kufras. She selected the one with the least distance from her current location and was then faced with the names of 12 lodging options, their ads and contact information flashing on the sidebar.
She scowled, reading each carefully. None of their names sounded familiar.
Show in map.
The city of Kufra spilled out across the screen, a satellite-taken photograph that, after a moment of squinting at the brown-tinted roads, began to breach the gaps in her memory. Then, she spotted a courtyard outside one of the hotels and, after zooming onto the photo, recognized a lemon tree standing against one wall. She dared to smile and tapped on the hotel's contact information.
Establish comm link.
Within seconds, she found herself staring at the same clerk who had checked her in with Thorne, with Gina's help. She nearly collapsed with relief.
Thank you for coming.
Shh! Cress waved her arms, silencing the woman, and glanced at the man on the bed. He twitched, but only briefly.
Sorry,
she whispered. The woman leaned closer toward the screen to hear her.
My friend is sleeping. I need to speak with a guest at your hotel. His name is Carswell Smith. I believe he's in room 8.
She was glad when the woman's voice dropped low.
One moment.
She tapped something off screen. Cress jumped at a ping, but the man slept on. An alert appeared in the corner of the net screen. 97 new alerts regarding search Lynn Cinder. She blinked.
Lynn Cinder? I'm sorry, said the receptionist, snapping Cress's attention back to her. Mr. Smith left the hotel yesterday evening after causing a commotion with some of our other guests.
Her eyes had become suspicious as she scanned the dark room with increased curiosity.
In fact, we're currently undergoing an investigation, as some witnesses believe he may have been a wanted...
Cress canceled the link. Her nerves were writhing beneath her skin, and her lungs felt too small to take in all the air they needed. Thorne wasn't there. He'd had to run, and now she had no idea how to find him, and he was being hunted, and he would be captured, and she would never see him again. The screen pinged again. The alerts on Lynn Cinder had increased by 2. Lynn Cinder, New Beijing, Paris, Rio, France. The sequence began to click. Baffled, Cress pulled up the alerts. They were the same news stories she'd been wading through for weeks aboard the satellite. Criticisms and speculations and conspiracy theories and very little evidence. Still, no confirmed sightings. Still, no arrests made, and not even a mention of Captain Thorne, despite what the hotel clerk had said. And then, her attention caught on a headline, and her legs nearly buckled. She splayed her fingers on top of the desk to keep standing. Lunar accomplice Dmitri Erland still evading authorities. Dmitri Erland. The lunar doctor who had been on the Letimosis research team. The doctor who had helped Cinder escape from prison. The doctor who was, perhaps, the second most wanted fugitive on Earth, even more so than Thorne. She knew it was him even before she pulled up his picture. This was why the old man had struck her as familiar. She had seen him before. But wasn't he supposed to be on their side? She was so engrossed with her unanswered questions that she didn't hear the subtle creaking of the bed until a hand grabbed her. Chapter 39. Cress squeaked as she was spun around. She found herself staring into a face that was both handsome and murderous, his eyes glowing in the light of the net screen.
Who are you?
Her instinct was to scream, but she smothered it, choking off the noise until it was little more than a whimper.
I'm sorry for intruding, she said. I needed a net screen. My friend is in danger, and I needed to send a comm, and I'm so sorry. I promise I didn't steal anything. Please, don't call for the doctor, please.
He seemed to have stopped listening to her, instead sending his steely gaze around the room. He released her arm, but remained tense and defensive. He wasn't wearing a shirt, but he had bandages around his torso that covered him almost as much as a shirt would have.
Where are we? What happened?
His words were staggered and slurred. He grimaced, squeezing his eyes shut, and when he opened them again, it seemed that he couldn't quite focus on anything.
That's when Kress's attention caught on something more terrifying than his faded scars and intimidating muscles. He had a tattoo on his arm. It was too dark to read it, but Kress knew instantly what it was. She'd seen them in countless videos and photographs and documentaries hastily cobbled together. He was a lunar special operative, one of the Queen's mutants. Visions of men digging their claws into their victims' chests, locking their jaws around exposed throats, howling at the moon, curled and crawled through her head. This time, she couldn't temper the instinct. She screamed. He grabbed her and forced her jaw shut with his enormous hands. She sobbed, trembling. She was about to die. Her body would pose no more resistance to him than a twig. He snarled, and she could make out the sharp points of his teeth.
"You should have killed me when you had the chance,"
he said, his breath hot on her face.
"You turned me into this, and I will kill you before I become another experiment. Do you understand me?"
Tears began to work their way out of her lashes. Her jaw was aching where he held her, but she was more afraid of what would happen when he let go. Did he think she worked for the doctor? Could it be that he was just one more victim sold off to the old man? He was lunar, so they had that much in common. If she could convince him that they were allies, maybe she could get away long enough to run, but could these monsters even be reasoned with?
"Do you understand me?"
Her lashes fluttered, and the door behind him opened. His moves were fast and fluid, and Kress's head spun as the man turned and pulled her in front of him, plastering her against his chest. He stumbled as if the sudden movement had made him dizzy, but caught himself as light spilled into the room. A silhouette stood in the doorway. Not the old man, but a guard. A lunar guard. Kress's eyes widened with recognition. Sybil's guard. The pilot in Sybil's pod ship. Who could have saved her but didn't? The wolf operative hissed. Kress would have collapsed if his grip hadn't been so firm. Sybil had found her. Sybil was here. Her tears began to spill over. She was trapped. She was dead.
"Take one step and I'll snap her neck."
The guard said nothing. Kress wasn't sure he'd even heard the threat. His eyebrows were raised as he surveyed the scene, and he seemed to recognize her. But rather than look victorious, he seemed merely stunned.
"What have... Scarlet?"
The words were almost incomprehensible beneath a growl.
"Where's Scarlet?"
"Aren't you that hacker?" said the guard, still staring at Kress.
The operative's grip tightened.
"You have 5 seconds to tell me where she is, or this girl is dead, and you're next."
"I'm not with them," Kress choked. He doesn't care about me."
The guard raised his hands in a placating gesture. Kress wondered where Mistress Sybil was. When the operative's hold didn't loosen, it occurred to her that both of these men worked for the Lunar Queen. Why would they be threatening each other?
"Just relax," said the guard. "Let me get Cinder or the doctor. They can explain."
The operative flinched.
"Cinder?"
"She's out in the ship."
His gaze dipped again to Kress.
"Where do you come from?"
She gulped, her head ringing with the same question the operative had posed.
"Cinder?
What's going on here?"
She shuddered at the doctor's voice, stronger than it had been during his negotiations with Gina. Then, footsteps. The guard stepped aside to let the doctor into the room, still dark but for the corridor light. Kress couldn't help but feel a sting of pride to see that she'd left a mark on his jaw. Though lots of good her newfound courage had done her in the end. The doctor froze and took in the scene.
"Oh, stars," he muttered, "of all the bad timings."
Though the sight of him reignited Kress's hatred, she also remembered that this was not just some cruel old man who traded for lunar slaves. This was the man who had helped Cinder escape. Her head spun.
"Let her go," said the doctor, speaking gently. "We are not your enemies. That girl is not your enemy. Please, allow me to explain."
Wolf pulled an arm away from her, dragging a hand down his face. He swayed for a moment before recovering his balance.
"I've been here before," he muttered. "Cinder, Africa?"
Loud thumping on the distant staircase intruded on his confusion. Then there was yelling, and Cress thought she heard her name, and the voice?
Cress!
She cried out, forgetting about the vice-like grip around her, except that it kept her from launching herself toward him.
Captain! Cress!
The doctor and the guard both spun around as the footsteps barreled down the hall, and they all watched as Captain Thorne, blindfolded, ran right past the door.
Captain, I'm in here!
The footsteps stopped and reversed as he ran back until his cane smacked the doorframe. He froze, panting, one hand braced on the jamb. He had a furious bruise across one side of his face, though it was largely hidden by the bandana.
Cress, are you all right?
Her relief didn't last.
Captain, to your left there's a lunar guard, and on your right is a doctor who's running tests on lunars, and I'm being held by one of Lavanna's wolf hybrids, and please, be careful!
Thorne took a step back into the hallway and pulled a gun from his waistband. He spent a moment swiveling the barrel of the gun in each direction, but nobody moved to attack him. With some surprise, Cress realized that the operative's grip had weakened. Thorne furrowed his brow, aiming the gun somewhere near the window. Could you describe all those threats again, because I feel like I missed something.
Thorne.
He pointed the gun toward Wolf and Cress between them. Who said that? Who are you? Have you hurt her? Because I swear, if you hurt her... The lunar guard reached forward and plucked the gun out of his hand.
Hey!
Furious, Thorne raised his cane, but the guard easily blocked the blow with his forearm, then took the cane away too. Thorne raised his fists.
That's enough, yelled the doctor. No one is hurt, and no one is going to get hurt.
Snarling, Thorne turned to face him.
That's what you think, Wolfman, doctor.
Wait, Cress, which one is this?
I am Dr. Dimitri Erland, and I am a friend of Lynn Cinders. You might know me as the man who helped her escape from New Beijing prison.
Thorne snorted. Nice story, except I'm pretty sure I'm the one who helped Cinder escape from prison.
Hardly. The man you just hit is also an ally of Cinder's, as is the lupine soldier who is still on heavy painkillers and probably delirious, and who will no doubt pull out some stitches if he doesn't lie down right away.
Thorne,
the operative said again, ignoring the doctor's warnings.
What's going on? Where are we? What happened to your eyes?
Thorne cocked his head.
Wait. Wolf? Yes.
There was a long, long pause before understanding filled Thorne's expression, and he laughed.
Hey, Sis Cress, you nearly gave me a heart attack with that wolf hybrid comment. Why didn't you just tell me it was him?
Where's Cinder? Asked Thorne.
I don't know, said Wolf. And where... I thought Cinder said something about Scarlet before.
With one arm still loosely tied around Cress's neck, he dragged his free hand down his face, moaning.
Just a nightmare?
Cinder is here. She's safe, said the doctor.
Thorne grinned, the biggest, most enigmatic grin Cress had seen since the satellite. Cress gaped around the room, nearly hyperventilating as her worldview flip-flopped before her. Sybil's guard, who she had last seen on his way to board the Rampion. Could he have betrayed Sybil and joined them? The doctor who had helped Cinder escape from prison. The wolf operative. Only now, with Thorne's recognition, did she realize that this was the man she'd seen on the video feed when they'd first contacted her. And somewhere, Cinder.
Safe.
They were safe. Thorne held out his hand, and the guard put the cane back into it.
Cress, are you all right?
He crossed the room and bent down as if he could inspect her, or kiss her, though he didn't.
Are you hurt?
No, I'm all right. The words were so foreign, so impossible, so liberating.
How did you find me?
One of Gina's men told me the name of this place. And all I had to do was mention Crazy Doctor to the folks outside, and they all knew just who I was talking about.
Knees suddenly weak, she reached for his forearms to stabilize herself.
You came for me.
He beamed, looking for all the world like a selfless, daring hero. Don't sound so surprised. Dropping the cane, he pulled her into a crushing embrace that tore her away from Wolf and lifted her clean off the floor. It turns out you are worth a lot of money on the black market.